You're listening to the Boogeyman's Closet podcast. Explicit language and spoilers ahead. You've been warned.
We are back for yet another episode of the Boogeyman's Closet. As always, I am Mike Alvarez.
Maurice Killover.
Susie Hunt.
And we have a guest joining us again today.
Eric Butel.
Thank you for joining us once again, Eric. Always a pleasure to have you.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, you guys, for having me again.
So I feel like Eric has definitely reached the status of recurring character. So if Don is going to be Charo, who could Eric be?
Oh, that's one we're going to have to noodle.
Yeah.
We'll have to look at the Love Boat and see like who else was a reoccurring character. But we are continuing our month of cannibal films with episode 71, Ravenous, from 1999. It's an hour and 41 minutes and directed by Antonia Bird. She also did The Men's Room, Priest, and Mad Love. Now, we'll go around the table. Eric, as you are our guest, it is customary we start with you. What are your thoughts on Ravenous?
This is a perfect movie. I love this movie. It has something very punk rock about it to me. Only in the sense of like, oh, it's not like exactly giving the middle finger, but just like the structure of it and the tone of it is like irreverent. And it's, you know, it's also like serious about, you know, addiction and fear and just all these different things going on. And it's a perfect blend and it works very, very well. And it's directed well, it's acted well. It's just a perfect movie. And the music is like, it's a little bit, I know I'm going to go back to it again, but like that I Know What You Did Last Summer thing, even though it was starring like CW stars and stuff, for all that gloss, it was like a big widescreen horror movie. Mm-hmm. And this movie is definitely like, it was shot in widescreen and you can feel it, and it's just a beautiful, gorgeous, I don't even know if it's a horror movie. Obviously it's full of blood and guts, but it just hits so many things and it does them all right.
Oh man, I couldn't agree. I couldn't agree more. Now, Susie, I believe you said this was your first viewing, so we'll go to you next. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, it popped my ravenous cherry, all right. I really liked this movie, like really liked it. And I know, Mike, you had commented, like you had messaged me and Maurice about the score. Oh, it's so fucking perfect. It's like Little House on the Prairie meets Home on the Range meets why can't I think of the movie?
Deliverance.
Thank you. I'm sorry, it's been a long day.
Lots of
but bandage. I loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved how it wasn't as gory as The Green Inferno or Raw. Mm-hmm. But it's point across and it was brilliantly done. I think, well, I'll get into what I think about Boyd, but the cast is amazing, even though Jeffrey Jones is a pedo bear, registered sex offender. But he, like, everyone in the cast was fantastic. Robert Carlyle was brilliant. Like, I didn't even see that coming at first, but I can't recommend this movie enough. I'm really glad that the fans picked a movie that I've never seen and I enjoyed so much.
I'm like so jealous of you that this is like your first time seeing it. Like
I know, right?
I can't believe the first time I watched it, I was just blown away.
I can believe if like it was a movie that came out within the last, you know, couple years. But this movie came out when I was in college. I was going to the movies all the time. How did I miss this gem?
As a 21-year-old classic at this point.
Yeah, and like the little bits of humor sprinkled in, like in the beginning. And then like when shit starts happening, like, oh my God, it just happens. And I loved it.
Maurice, what about you? What are your thoughts on this?
Well, this is also my first time viewing it.
Oh, no what? Shit.
Ooh, two ravenous cherries popped in one show.
Damn. All right, so what are your thoughts then?
Well, I guess I'm going to be the odd man out. I just thought it was okay.
Oh, I was going to say, you didn't like it?
I know it's bracing.
I don't know. I just, it didn't really do anything for me, to be honest with you. Maybe it's because I waited so long to watch it in life. I don't know. Maybe I would have liked it better if I saw it when it came out. I mean, I thought it was, the acting was great.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. I thought they were trying to be a little too silly for that kind of movie. It was like watching Monty Python. Like a Monty Python cannibal movie.
Monty Python's Windigy.
Do you think it was like overhyped for you? Like from horror fans or anything like that?
No, I mean, I've never really heard anyone ever talk about the movie, to be honest with you.
Oh.
And I thought it was cool that they went I like the whole Wendigo story.
Mm-hmm. Wendigo.
Well,
yeah, they kept saying Wendigo, but yeah, Wendigo. Yeah, Wendigo.
Yeah.
It's Wendigo. It's Wendigo. I know. But I mean, I'm not saying I hated it. I'm just saying I thought it was an okay movie. I don't think it's something that's that great. That's just my opinion. But
yeah,
there are a lot of positives from the movie. Like I said, the acting was good. The music was good, and I don't know. I couldn't get into it.
Man, well, I mean, hey, this has been it's been a while since we've had some disagreements on the show as far as, you know, how much we dug it. I have to agree with Eric. This is like, I freaking love this movie. This is probably my second favorite cannibal movie of all time, like Texas Chainsaw being top spot. This is really close behind. This is one of those movies that I watch almost every year. Sometimes a couple times a year. Like I know last year I watched it like three times just cause I was on a kick with it. I don't know why I was like obsessed with period piece horror. But yeah, this I've gone back to again and again and again. I saw it in the theater without knowing like much at all. Like I had seen like one trailer and I went to go see it with some friends and I immediately fell in love with the soundtrack, like the score. I was like, it's so quirky and strange, but there was something about it that was just grabbing me right from the get-go. And my God, like the acting, oh, they're all so good. Robert Carlyle is amazing. Guy Pearce is amazing. Like, I mean, yeah, Jeffrey Jones, it's unfortunate what he is, but as an actor, he was really good in this. Everyone
Damian Dark was fantastic.
Legends of Tomorrow.
But
and Arrow.
And what?
I know, well, Legends of Tomorrow, but Damian Dark originated on the Arrow TV show. It was the crossover.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, they were all just, I mean, everything about it, all the actors were great. I love the humor. You guys know me. I love humor sprinkled in my horror. My favorite types of horror movies are like dark comedy. And I mean, don't get me wrong. I love a silly horror. I love stuff like Basket Case or Cannibal the Musical, like stuff that's just, you know, friggin' silly. But I prefer stuff where it's like the horror is still kind of serious, but there's still plenty of humor sprinkled throughout. And this did not disappoint in that regard. But yeah, I mean, let's just get right into it because there's so much to say. But we got the cast. Captain John Boyd, played by Guy Pearce. We would know him from Memento, The Time Machine, The Hurt Locker, Don't Be Afraid of the Dark, Prometheus, Iron Man 3.
Priscilla, horrible... Queen of the Desert.
I was just gonna say, I like that one, but I was gonna say that horrible Alien Covenant. And then he was also in that the recent TV version of The Christmas Carol. Then we have Colonel Ives / F.W. Calhoun, played by Robert Carlyle. Train Spotting, obviously, The Full Monty, The World Is Not Enough, 28 Weeks Later, Being Human, Priest, and Stargate Universe. Then Private Cleaves, played by David Arquette. He was in the Buffy the Vampire Slayer movie, Airheads, Friends, Scream 1 through 4, and the upcoming Part 5. Riding the Bullet, which is a really fun Stephen King adaptation, if you guys haven't seen it. Bone Tomahawk and Creepshow, the TV show, or the Shudder streaming show. Private Toffler, played by Jeremy Davies. Twister, Saving Private Ryan, Helter Skelter, Lost, Hannibal, Sleepy Hollow, Twin Peaks, American Gods, and most recently, The House That Jack Built, which I still haven't seen, but I've heard nothing but good things about.
You know why you got that response from me?
Actually, I'm not sure now.
Maurice and I have been telling you to watch that movie.
This is the Lars von Trier movie, right?
Yeah, that's what I was going to say. That was.
Oh, no. The House of Jack Built. No, I'm thinking of a different movie. But you should watch. That's The House of Jack Built is the one with Matt Dillon. That yes. is fantastic. You need to watch it.
Oh, okay. I was going to say, wait a second. I don't remember. Because I remember when it came out in the theater and me not having a chance to go see it. But I definitely, it is on my list. I'm
thinking of the Elijah Wood movie that Maurice had to watch. I got him confused. But The House That Jack Built, you need to watch it.
Yeah, no, I've heard it's disturbing. then we have Colonel Hart, played by Jeffrey Jones, Amadeus, Transylvania 65,000, obviously Ferris Bueller's Day Off, it's probably his most famous, Howard the Duck, Beetlejuice, Tales from the Crypt, he was in Creep Course, which is a great episode with Anthony Michael Hall that involves a mummy, and I'm just going to leave it there because the twist is so fantastic, I don't want to ruin it, but he, Jeffrey Jones, kills somebody by liquefying their insides and having it come out all of their orifices, which is interesting. Hmm. But he was also in, do you guys remember Stay Tuned?
With,
yes. Predator?
Yes. I freaking love that movie. It's so silly. But then we have General Slauson, played by John Spencer. He was in War Games, Miami Vice, Another World, Law and Order, Duckman, one of my favorite cartoons, The Rock and The West Wing. Then Knox, played by Steven Spinella, Great Expectations, Bubble Boy, Frasier, 24, Nip Tuck, and Rubber, which one of these days we will get Rubber on this show. So
I want to be on that one.
It's such a fucking weird movie. Oh, man, yes, you could be on that one. That would be awesome. Private Reich, played by Neil McDonough, Darkman, Quantum Leap, Duckman, Star Trek, The X-Files. I mean, this guy is all over the place. Captain America, the First Avenger, Agents of S.H.I.E.L.D., Yellowstone, and most recently in Sonic the Hedgehog. But he's been cast as Dr. William Birkin for the upcoming reboot of Resident Evil, which has me really excited because I guess they're following really closely the game story. So, yeah, and then I guess they're starting with Part 2. So I'm like, all right, this is fantastic. Part 2 is my favorite, so let's go. Then we have George, played by Joseph Running Fox. He was in Porky's 2 the next day, The Untouchables, and Sons of Anarchy. Then Lindis, played by Bill, I'm going to say this wrong, Broktrup? Broktrup? I don't know how to say it. Elf, Rockula, Dragnet, The Arrival, and Murder, She Wrote, which is the reason I put him on the list.
Okay.
And Martha, played by Sheila Towsey. She was in Thunderheart, Law and Order, Lord of Illusions, another one we will get on this show. And The X-Files. So, really good cast. A lot of great people in this. But for those of you that haven't seen it, which surprisingly, we had two boogeymen here that did not see it. So, we're going to say the plot of this film is there's in a remote military outpost in the 19th century, Captain John Boyd and his regiment embark on a rescue mission which takes a dark turn when they're ambushed by a sadistic cannibal. So, It's an interesting cannibal flick. But we open right away. We open with a Nietzsche quote. It says, he that fights with monsters should look to it that he himself does not become a monster. And then it is quickly followed up by Eat Me, Anonymous, which I found quite amusing. But we see Captain John Boyd being honored at a dinner for heroism above and beyond the call of duty, for successfully infiltrating the enemy's ranks and securing victory independently with cunning and honor. Then we smash cut to Boyd lying down and playing dead on the battlefield while his men are slaughtered all around him. It says Mexican-American War, 1847. We cut back to the dinner. We see all the men digging into these bloody rare steaks. Boyd looks down at his. It starts breathing heavily, looking more and more nauseous. Then it cuts to him playing possum under a pile of dead men while blood is like pouring down all over his face and in his mouth. And then we cut back to him at the dinner table. He looks at his steak, runs off, starts puking, and then we get the title card. So pretty cool opening.
In his defense, though, everyone else's steak looked, you know, a little more cooked. His looked like they dusted some brown powder on it and slapped it on his plate, which is not everybody's cup of tea.
True. True.
I mean, listened. You know. Sorry.
Oh, no, go ahead. Go ahead.
I listened to the director's commentary on this, and they were saying that it was just like the smell was just nauseating, and they were cooking the steaks. Well, I mean, as much as they did for every take. So for every guy at the table, they were cooking a new steak for the new take that they were doing. And the guy sitting next to Guy Pearce apparently had some sort of like seizure or something and fainted just because of the stench.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Huh. So I don't know if it was a seizure, but I think he fainted or something like that, she said.
Well, I know not only it's a scene that's coming up later, but I know that Guy Pearce was a vegetarian, probably still is, but it was the stew scene. That's what I'm thinking of. He was shoving the meat in his mouth and chomping on it, and then after each take, he would spit it out. They were saying like the director was like he took it like a champ. So he dealt with that for his art. So
is it weird? So. I have a, like, there's something triggering about this movie for me personally, and this will solidify me as a complete weirdo. I saw this movie, it came out in 99, so I was graduating from high school. It was my first year at community college, and I had rented it, and I came home because I had, like, an odd class timing, and so, like, I had, like, 5 hours to kill. And I, like, made lunch and turned this movie on. And I remember eating, like, a sandwich or something through it. And for some odd reason, whenever I watch this movie, I get hungry. Like, I'm not making... when you mentioned the stew, I was like, I remember that stew looking really good.
Well, I mean, to be fair, it's a lamb stew, and I love lamb stew. So,
and I mean, Robert Carlyle just makes it look good. He's, you know, dicing everything up for it. But anyways, sorry. But yeah, no.
And it's got that sizzle in the pot. I bet that fond on the bottom is fucking tits.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, no, I mean, I don't think it's that weird, honestly, because, like, there's a few movies that make me hungry that shouldn't make me hungry. One of them being Texas Chainsaw Massacre. Really? Every time they stop and get the barbecue, and Franklin's just, like, gnawing on sausages, I'm like, I want some barbecue. Like, every single time I watch it.
And I'm like, usually when I see, even in real life, too, some people, but, like, when I see people eating on screen... It revulses me.
Yep.
Oh, like, it doesn't
I have no idea why. And they did this in like a ton of 80s like slashers movies. Like if you were had like an ounce of fat on you, you had to be eating a chocolate bar at the same time.
Oh, and, yeah.
Like, it might stem from that. But like whenever I see people like eating on screen, like, oh, this is good. It's like, I don't want to watch you eating. But this movie, I don't know what it is.
There are certain films, and actually we have discussed this, I want to say it was The Toxic Avenger. There are certain films that go out of their way to disgust you with food. And any trauma movie, like Trauma is notorious for it. But you know, but like Friday the 13th Part 5, we got the dude with the chocolate bar all smeared on his face.
God, stop. And, like, that's the grossest thing in any Friday the 13th movie.
But like, but seriously, like there's a lot, and you're right, 80s movies were notorious for it, where they used food to gross out their audience. And that is a very prominent thing in horror films. But yeah, I gotta admit, like, first of all, watching people on screen eat doesn't bother me at all. I mean, me and Jess watch tons of like cooking shows and those like the cooking challenge shows and all that, like Chopped and stuff. So I'm used to watching people eat on screen, never bothers me. But it is surprising what will make me hungry in a horror movie. And I'm glad you said that, because I'm like, hey, I'm not the only one. But so we cut to after the title card. We cue this amazing music. As we've mentioned at the top, the score is fucking fantastic. It's a strange, strange score. I will be posting the trailer on our social media, but I will try to track down some of the score and just post that on there, because it's such a good score. But we cut to General Slauson telling Boyd that he's no hero and he wants him as far away from his company as possible. So he's sending him to California, to Fort Spencer. We get the opening credits while Boyd is traveling to Fort Spencer with Martha. And it's kind of like they're wandering across the wilderness. We see the fort in the distance and the credits are rolling. Boyd arrives and is shown to his room. And as soon as his door closes, he stares at himself in like a very dirty mirror and has a flashback about his men being overrun and slaughtered as they call for him for help. And he just lays down and plays dead. So clearly he's plagued by what he did in the war. Then we cut to Colonel Hart talking to Boyd, and he seems a bit suspicious of how a war hero was rewarded by being sent to Fort Spencer. So, you know, quote unquote, rewarded.
He was demoted.
Exactly. And this is important because it'll play a role later, but Hart is struggling to open some walnuts. Gets a huge book and tells Boyd that his hobby is reading in the original languages and languages in general. And he goes, it's tedious, I know, but then this place thrives on tedium. And then he uses the book to smash the walnuts open and offers him some walnuts. And he goes, do you have any hobbies, Boyd? And he goes, swimming. And he goes, swimming, eh? Well, I hope you don't mind hard water, because it's all frozen and wintry where they are. And he goes on to give Boyd a little history lesson on Fort Spencer, telling him that the Spanish had built it as a mission. They inherited it, and now it's a way station for Western travelers on their way to the Nevadas. He goes on to tell him that they don't get much traffic during the winter, so they maintain only a skeleton company. And now we get this montage of each of the characters as Hart kind of explains who they are.
It's a ragtag group of soldiers.
Exactly. So we see, he goes, Private Toffler, who's our personal emissary from the Lord, and we see him like up on top of one of the buildings, like trying to straighten across. Then he says, Major Knox, who never met a bottle he didn't like, and we see Knox passed out in front of the fire, dropping an empty glass. Then he goes, Private Reich, he's our soldier, and we just see Reich standing naked in icy waters, screaming. And he just goes, I'd steer clear of him. And he goes, and Martha, you've met. Bet you didn't get a word out of her. And then we see Martha tending to the horses, just looking, you know, never, like, her face never changes throughout the entire movie. She's just got this deadpan expression. And then he says, and George, her brother, they're both locals. They sort of came with the place. And we see George smoking a peace pipe with Private Cleves, who is clearly high as fuck. Oh. And he goes, and then there's Private Cleves, the over-medicated Private Cleves. And he goes, and you and I make eight. He goes, Cleves cooks. Knox used to be a veterinarian, so he plays doctor. My advice to you is don't get sick. I tell you, I tell you not to eat, but then again, we all kind of have to do that. He goes, so with your promotion, you'd be number three in command. Now, we cut to the group at dinner. Hart tries to get everyone's attention so Toffler can say the blessing. And Reich just looks at him and starts eating immediately. He's like, fuck that noise, and just starts chowing down. And then Toffler starts mumbling almost like inaudibly, like you could barely hear him. Hart cuts him off and says, "Amen." Okay. They all start eating and toffling.
And he continues praying.
Yeah.
And then we cut to, we see Cleves and George just like looking at each other, giggling, still both high as fuck. Then we cut outside to Boyd. He's like standing outside at dusk, walks out to the edge of the fort and stares out into the wilderness. And then we get a flashback of him talking to his commanding officers, and they're asking what happened. So we get this little conversation where he says, "How'd you get behind the enemy line?" He said, "I froze. I was scared." He goes, "Scared? You froze while the rest of your unit fought and died? What did you do then?" "I played dead. But you made it behind enemy lines. I was buried with my commanding officer's half shot off head in my face, blood running down my throat," which that is very important. He said, "Now, how did you take the command post?" He goes, something had changed. And we see Boyd underneath the pile of corpses. His mouth and face is just covered in blood. He slowly starts pulling himself up from under the pile, sneaks up on a soldier, breaks the guy's neck, takes his gun, and takes over the command. And they say, we're going to promote you, Boyd. We could shoot you, but as you single-handedly captured the enemy command, it might set a bad precedent." So we cut back to Boyd at Fort Spencer. And we see that Cleves and Martha are going out on a supply run. Hart gives Cleves a last-minute list of items and tells him to read it back to him. I didn't write down the list, but he's like, meat, potatoes, salt, all. he's all giddy reading it all off. And he goes, "No loco weed, no peyote, and no women." And then Martha reiterates, "No women," and Cleves giggles like a fucking dummy. I love it because when they're heading out, Cleves is still reading off the list.
He's okay. Like, "I can't get a woman if I want to."
Yeah. Because he's the lead. He goes, after he goes, "Bacon, oil, loco weed, peyote." And she goes, "No." And he goes, "And women. I couldn't get a woman if I wanted to."
I love this. I like the ensemble, and I like that everybody just clicks so well together. It feels lived in.
Oh yeah. No, every like I said, the cast in this flick is really good. So we cut to later that night. We see Boyd looking at his medal, and Hart asks him what he got the medal for, and Boyd tells him for cowardice. Hart invites him to come have a drink with him, and he says that they drink to escape. We see Toffler playing the piano, and Hart comes out and he goes, "What are you doing, Toffler?" And he goes, "Oh, I'm writing a religious hymn. I'm composing a religious hymn." And he goes, "Oh, can you find inspiration elsewhere?" And then he just closes the door on him. It's like, oh, then he comes back out with a bucket and he goes, "Oh, and we need some ice." And he just shakes the bucket at him. I was like, they're horrible to this guy. Poor Toffler. So yeah, we cut back to Hart and Boyd, and he says that, "Funny thing, we escape the world, we come here. Then we turn right around and try to escape this place." And he pours them both a drink. And he says, "The frightening thing about escape, though, is the chance that you might end up somewhere worse." Suddenly, Boyd sees a man out in the snow looking in the windows of the fort at them.
A random mountain hobo.
Exactly. So they rush out, they get him, the guy's barely alive, bring him inside and try to revive him. So they like put him in a tub and start pouring hot water on him, trying to warm him up. They're, you know, rubbing his extremities, trying to get the blood flowing again. But
I mean, when he wakes up and stands up, there's dead ass, so
this is true.
Get the blood flowing.
Okay.
I was just gonna bring this back, like, I'm not gonna change anybody's mind here, but like Maurice, like when you were talking about like the kind of like too much like poking fun and silliness, is like the introduction and with all these characters, like the David Arquette like getting super high, and then like cutting to Reich being like just an insane super soldier that probably annoyed his superiors, and that's why he was sent to this hellhole. Like, is that like just kind of like the two on the nose thing that you didn't like, or
yeah? I mean, then you got, you know, the whole Toffler. I mean, where they make him, he's really weird.
Yeah,
I don't know.
I didn't mean to pick on you. I was just like, I was interested because I could see that totally. Just like that has like that shit's like turned me off in other movies too. So like I understand, and I was just like, oh, like I never even like it. Just worked differently for me.
I mean, I mean, the way it started, I was gonna, you know, I was kind of thinking, oh, is this gonna be like a stoner kind of team, and you know, and I'm not really a huge fan of David Arquette, so to begin with, so
that's the movie's first sin.
See, now I'm a huge Scream nut, so I love him.
I like Scream. I just don't like him.
But no, I mean, I've heard from several people with this film where it's either something that they love or it's something that they're kind of like, I didn't really understand why everyone liked it so much. You know, it never seems to be hated. Like, I've never met someone that just outright dislikes this movie. But most people
I'm far from hating it. Like,
right. But I feel like,
I'd give it another chance. I would sit down and watch it again just to, you know, personally, this hasn't been the best week for me.
Right.
As you guys all know. So my head's not really been in the game. I've had other things on my mind. So
plus sometimes it takes a couple viewings for a movie to really gel. You know, like, I know that there's been plenty of movies out there that I didn't really, in fact, I believe plenty of movies on this show where I either really liked it the first time around and then watching it later with fresh eyes, I was like, this is terrible, or vice versa, where I was just kind of like, meh, the first time I watched it and then came back to it and ended up really digging it. You know, right. I mean, that happens.
I mean, it's happened to me with a lot of the movies on the show. So
absolutely.
I think with a better mindset, I would probably, you know, give it more of a look, you know.
Right.
Yeah. I was just asking because I recently rewatched Cabin in the Woods, which I love. Mm. And when I rewatched it, like, and you mentioning that you were like, it's kind of like jokey or whatever. I was watching Cabin in the Woods and I was like, I know that's like kind of the whole premise of that film, but I was like, I'm like, I can't tell if this is like insulting horror movies anymore. What? And like, I liked it. I loved the ending of that movie, the whole last half hour or whatever. But yeah, it was like a movie I never thought I would ever dislike. And rewatching it, I was like, this is almost like too much. But I don't know. So I didn't know if this was like sort of similar.
I mean, I knew walking in, it being a Joss Whedon movie, that it was going to be what it was.
Oh, yeah. No, Cabin in the Woods, as we discussed on the show, like, we all gushed about that one. I fucking love that movie. It's like a perfect commentary on horror.
Yeah.
But so, yeah, we see they are reviving this mountain hobo, as Susie put it. And he stands up butt-ass naked. He's like, oh, good Lord. And he covers himself. They give him some clothes, and he gives them an explanation. He tells them that his name is F.W. Calhoun, and he tells them his story. Tell me a story.
He was on the Oregon Trail, and most of his party died of dysentery.
Oh my God, I wish I had a thought to write that. Oh, that's too perfect. So yeah, basically.
And then they turn into the Donner Party.
Yes. They were traveling. It was to Nevada, right, or through the Nevadas? They were on their way to California, right?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, I didn't write down where they were, like where they were on their way to. But he tells them that they ended up going through, following a Colonel Ives. He said a military man. He said he was the most disastrous guide. He was basically showing them a shorter, quote unquote, route. And it ended up being a very treacherous route, and they ended up getting stuck by the time the first snowfall. They were still 100 miles from their destination. So at one point he had said, we were without food for 3 months. And Reich goes, you didn't eat for 3 months? And he goes, I said we were without food. I didn't say there wasn't anything to eat. And that's when he starts telling this whole story. He said that they couldn't proceed in the snow, so they took shelter in a cave to hopefully wait out the storm. But the storm didn't pass, and the trail soon became impassable. He said they ran out of food, so they ate the oxen. Then they ate the horses. And he says, and we even ate my own dog. He said all of that lasted them about a month. Now, I mean, I get it. There's six of them. But an oxen is a big motherfucker. You ate an ox and what, three horses and a dog in a month? Like, okay, maybe you guys could have rationed a little bit.
Right.
Well, doesn't he say that he tried to ration, but his
his
people weren't as frugal?
Yeah, that they, well, that's a different part of the conversation.
Okay.
Because he says after they ran out of food, they turned to their belts and shoes, and any roots they could dig up, but there's no in any of that. And he said, Jones died first from malnutrition. He said, I was out collecting wood when it happened. When I returned, the others were cooking his legs for dinner. And like, we just see like the crowd gasp. And he says, would I have stopped it had I been there? I don't know. But I must say, when I stepped inside that cave, the smell of meat cooking, I thanked the Lord. And then he starts crying and he says that he thanked the Lord. He repeats himself. He says, and then things got out of hand. He goes, I ate sparingly. The others did not. The meat did not last us a week. And soon we were hungry again, only this time the hunger was different, more severe, savage. And Colonel Ives particularly could not be satisfied. And then he goes on to explain that Giannis was the first to be killed, and we see Giannis getting cracked upside the head. And then he says, then Mr. McCready, and we see Mr. McCready get an axe to the back. And then he says, leaving only Calhoun, leaving only myself, Colonel Ives, and Miss McCready. And he says, I knew in that company my days were limited. So he goes, I'm ashamed to admit I ran. So basically he left Mrs. McCready behind and took off because he knew that, you know, if it was between a woman or him, you know, Ives was going to kill him.
It's very interesting, the point that he makes about the hunger being different. And it's like this insatiable hunger, and it's savage because, right. And I know that I didn't record Raw, but I've seen the movie a couple times. It's the same thing. Like when Justine first has that bite of meat, it becomes an insatiable hunger for her.
Right. Well, and that's something that we see a lot in cannibal flicks in general, that the cannibals become obsessed specifically with human meat. Like even with Texas Chainsaw, like you look at Texas Chainsaw, like obviously they're killing animals and stuff, but when you follow the mythology and go into especially part two, you see that they are really obsessed particularly with human meat. And that happens a lot in these types of films. But with this story, which I mean we'll get to the core of its mythology, but what it's based on is that tale of like once it's like Pringles, once you pop, you can't stop. You know, it's,
right?
They have to continue to eat human meat.
I think.
Oh no, go ahead.
I do think it's really interesting how he crafts this tale about that insatiableness, and then later he, you know, references Manifest Destiny. Mm-hmm. And sort of that addiction and like wanting more, not stopping. And then also like looking, it reminded me a little bit of Interview with a Vampire, but we can get to that in a second. But also like his story, the way it's crafted is a little bit like Boyd's. And mm-hmm. So I think that's where like Boyd's like kind of first kind of lured in by Ives, whether he knows, or Calhoun, sorry, whether he knows it or not. Like, I think it's he sees kind of like another person like himself, even though, you know, we find out, but.
Does that want to live deliciously?
Exactly. Yeah. Well, no, the main villain and the main hero in the story are two sides of the same coin, which is, I think any of your best tales are going to have that, where they mirror one another really closely. And so yeah, our hero and our villain are like, they're one and the same.
Which it's like just that, it's like this dance, this like you know, this, it's this weird kind of like vampire romance kind of thing.
And oh, I don't very mean
that like a Twilight kind of way at all.
No, but it is very similar Especially once we find out like what happens toward the end, like it's very similar. And I definitely understand the Interview with the Vampire reference because the reasoning, we'll just say, is very similar. Yeah. Basically, Hart asks Calhoun, "Is Miss McCready still there?" And he tells them, "And Ives too, as far as I know." And Hart tells the men to pack up. Toffler kind of freaks out and he's like, "What do we do?" And he goes, "We have to go. It's our job." So they get their things. Hart tells them that the cave is about 3 to 4 days' march from there, and then George grabs Hart and Boyd and pulls them aside, and he warns them of the Wendigo or Wendigo, and he shows them a drawing of a monstrous man eating a woman's flesh. And George starts speaking in his native tongue, and Hart translates to Boyd and for us. He says the entire time George is talking, he's looking increasingly nervous, and Boyd is kind of looking. He's also looking increasingly nervous. He says Hart goes on to say, "It's an old Indian myth from the north. A man eats another's flesh. It's usually an enemy, and he takes his strength, his essence, his spirit." And then he says his hunger becomes more craven, insatiable. And the more he eats, the more he wants to. The more he eats, the stronger he becomes. And then he says to George, "George, people still don't do that, do they?" And George stands up and speaks in his ear. And then Hart turns to Boyd and goes, "White man eats the body of Jesus Christ every Sunday." And George flips the Wendigo drawing over and there's a drawing of Jesus on it. I was like, that's okay. I get your point, buddy. So we see Hart, Reich, Boyd, Toffler, George, and Calhoun all leave for the cave, leaving Knox and Martha to hold down the fort. Or I'm sorry, leaving Knox to hold down the fort for when Martha and Cleves come back. So we see a montage of them traveling across the wilderness, you know, camping at night, and then with Toffler working on his hymn. Calhoun helps him work on his hymn, earning a little bit of trust there. And then we cut back to them traveling again. And they decide to take a break up in the snowy mountaintop. And Boyd asks Calhoun about eating human flesh. He said, "You said the hunger was more wanton." And he asked him if there's any physical changes. He goes, "Did you feel stronger?" And Calhoun nods and says, "I seem to recall something like that." And then he goes, "A certain virility. Why do you ask?" But before Boyd can answer, Toffler comes running up out of nowhere, holding a bone excitedly, like, "Look, it's a bone." I started laughing because I'm like, that's so random. Just, hey, a bone.
But so is Toffler, because think about, oh, wait, did it happen yet where he's composing the hymn?
Yeah.
And they're like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah. And he was working on the hymn at camp, and he was trying to find something that rhymes with servant.
Oh,
and
yes, yes.
Calhoun was like fervent, and then he was like, oh, and then he earned a little bit of Calhoun earned a little bit of Toffler's trust. But yeah, he comes running up holding the bone, and then he just slips and falls down the side of the mountain. Like, he just starts tumbling down these rocks. Reich goes running after him, trying to get him.
He didn't just go running. He fucking leapt off the precipice, landed about 6 feet down, and then did hop, skippy, jumpy all the way down. And he's like, he's fine.
He was
the
like,
rest of them are like, the fuck did he just do?
Like, but yeah, he gets down to Toffler and I love that because he yells up to everyone else, he's fine, and then looks at Toffler and goes, so how you doing? Like,
as his belly is like bleeding from the side. I can't believe he didn't fucking die from that fall.
I know. Next thing you know, his freaking rib is sticking out of his stomach.
Yeah. Yeah. They come back to camp and he is just covered in blood. I was like, ooh.
And that's the only injury he got, rib protruding from his belly, from his skin.
But so they're bandaging him up. And I love this because he timidly asks, he's like, I'll have some of that bourbon now. And they ignore him as per usual. He just goes, bourbon now! Just starts yelling for the bourbon.
And Hart's like, Hart looks at Boyd. He goes, would you please go administer some of this to Toffler? Just fucking swigs it like there's, like it's his last night on Earth. Foreshadow.
Well, he probably thought it was his last night on Earth.
Well, you know. But yeah, so
Reich he might takes, be He might be out lickety split.
So Reich is bandaging Toffler. Boyd hands Toffler the booze, and Reich notices that Boyd looks uncomfortable, and he says, "A war hero afraid of the sight of blood." And he kind of like smirks and kind of, you know, laughs a little bit at Boyd. Now we cut to that night and we hear a quiet muttering and we see a shadowy figure over one of the men. Toffler suddenly screams, waking the others.
They're like, what's going on? He's like, he was licking me.
Yeah, well, I love it too because he whispers it at first and Hart and Boyd look confused. Because Toffler's like pointing, and we see Calhoun with a little bit of blood on his mouth, and they're like,
"He's licking me!"
Right? And then he screams it, and Reich comes running in. Reich didn't ask no questions. He comes running in with a knife already pulled, and just holds it to Calhoun's throat. And then, I love it because Toffler goes, "He's like, yes, yes, kill him, yes." I was like, wow, you went from religious to murderous real quick.
And then Calhoun's basically like, I was having a nightmare that only Snacky Time Treats licking him could satisfy.
Mm. Well, this is the thing. Hart orders Reich to rebandage Toffler's wounds, and they pull Calhoun out of the tent. And
sick man out.
Yeah. Toffler goes, yeah, sick man outside. You sleep outside. Like he was a bad dog.
It's that little bit of humor peppered in with this horrific act of him like sampling the merchandise.
Exactly. So now outside, George looks freaked out. Like he's watching this whole thing. He's got his axe ready.
He's like, these white people are fucking crazy.
Exactly. And then that's when Calhoun starts begging them to restrain him. He's like, I can't be trusted. Please restrain me. After he tells them that he had a dream, he was having a nightmare about what happened. And next thing he knows, he was on top of Toffler licking his wound. So they go to restrain him. And George is just nodding like, yeah, yeah, tie his ass up. And then he looks at Boyd and goes, Wendigo. Like he tells him again, you know, as I'm telling you, man, he's crazy. But we cut to the next day. They're following the trail. They end up getting close to the cave, and Calhoun starts freaking out. The closer they get, he starts panicking and begging them not to make him go inside. Like, he's, like, having an all-out panic attack. Hart calls out at the entrance of the cave. He calls out for Miss MacReady and Colonel Ives. No one responds. So Boyd and Reich have to go into the cave while the others stand guard. Reich and Boyd, as they're walking through the cave, they find like this small hole in the cave, like in the floor, with a rope leading down. And Reich gets ready to climb down, and Boyd's like, "What the hell are you doing?" He's like, "Oh, you just go ahead and stand here if you're scared," or whatever. He's like basically teasing him about being afraid and being a war hero. So Reich climbs down into the cave, and I love it. There's this moment of physical comedy where Boyd is holding his gun down and holding a lantern, and Reich looks up, and the gun is pointed at his face. He's like, Captain? And he goes, oh, sorry. And he pulls his gun away. Like, you have a gun pointed at my head, buddy. Outside the cave, Calhoun starts acting really strange. Like, he's freaking out Toffler. He's kind of, like, muttering and grunting and, like, pointing and moving his hands around weird. Like, he looked like an animal, honestly. Yeah. And,
because they're in his, they entered into his clan of the cave cannibal bears.
Well, that's the thing. Down below in the little cave, Reich finds the remains of the party all hung up. So all these meaty skeletons hanging. And he counts the bodies and he realizes there's five of them.
And then he becomes Admiral Akbar.
Right.
It's a trap.
It's a trap.
Well, because he goes, he looks down, he goes, wait, five. He goes, he looks at the fifth one, he goes, then who are you? And he looks down and he sees military clothes and realizes that that's Ives. And he screams out, you know, it's a trap, like Maurice said. And they're trying to get out of back out of the cave. Outside, we see Calhoun drop to the ground and start digging like a fucking animal in the dirt. Like, he's just freaking out. And Reich is running out, yelling for the Colonel Hart, trying to
tell him. Kill him!
Kill him! He's the killer! And we see Calhoun pick up a knife from the hole that he dug and just rush at Hart and gut him. So he stabs him in the stomach, and he starts pulling the knife up, and then you see George throw his axe. He uses Hart as a human shield, who's still alive. Like, he's gurgling up blood, and he turns him and gets the axe to the back, and he's like,
And Toffler's just standing there, like, peeing his pants.
Right, he's got a gun.
Rightfully so.
I would have shot his ass, Jesus. But, so Calhoun takes Hart's gun and shoots George. And, you know, so George is down. And then he just drops Hart. Toffler stares at him, terrified. Calhoun holds up the gun, you know, points it at Toffler and clicks. And it's out of ammo. Like, Toffler just braces for impact. He's holding his rifle and just braces for death. And then when there's no ammo, he goes, "That's so annoying." He takes off his fur coat, covers up Hart, hunkers down and holds out a knife and just looks at Toffler and goes, "Run." And Toffler drops his gun and starts running away.
While he's screaming.
And I just wrote, and a banjo begins playing for the chase scene.
Mm-hmm. And then Boyd and Reich emerge from the cave. And I just want to say, Boyd is pretty fucking useless.
Oh, yeah. He really is.
Well, I mean, he's always been useless.
Yeah.
Yeah, but this just really solidifies it.
Yep.
I like this the scene too, because I feel like it's all one scene, but it changes tone and almost just through the music, but also like it kind of this is like the whole movie too, where it's like it kind of ratchets up, like the guy's Ives is going crazy, and like it just gets like beat by beat, like more and more intense until the killings, and then chasing Toffler almost seems like that sort of goofy, irreverent horror movie like Texas Chainsaw Massacre 2.
Right.
Kind of feel. And then it reverts back to, well, what like happens next with Boyd and Reich. Mm-hmm. It changes almost into like an action movie tone, all like within the same like 4 minutes.
Yeah. No, this is that scene that this entire sequence was often pulled for trailers. Like, there was a lot of information pulled from this little bit for the trailers before the film. Like, there's just because there's a lot of great set pieces in this sequence. So Toffler's running off, you know, Calhoun's chasing him. Boyd and Reich go running after Toffler. We see that, they're running off in the woods. We hear Toffler screaming, but they lose track of him. So Reich and Boyd are running through the woods, looking around, and then Calhoun spots Reich looking for him. Now, Calhoun's standing on, like, this cliffside, screams. Reich looks at him and goes running, but, you know, Calhoun takes off. So they find Toffler with his gut split open, and they, you know, unfortunately, Toffler's now dead. And then Reich and Boyd, like, Reich is ready to kill. He's like, we're taking this guy out. So they go after Calhoun. They see him. Reich takes a shot, but Calhoun's too fast. He misses him. Boyd is begging Reich to go back, but Reich is like, you know, man up, basically, we're killing this guy. So they go out onto this cliffside. And I mean, again, this set piece is great. It's just like overlooking the forest. And they can't find where Calhoun disappeared to. Like, there's nothing for him to hide behind. So where the fuck did he go? And Reich comes out onto the cliff, walks up pretty high. Calhoun jumps out of nowhere, throws the knife, hitting Reich in the gut. He fires his gun, falls down, tumbles off the cliffside. So, bye-bye, Reich.
I regret nothing!
And Boyd's reaction is perfect. Because he just holds up his rifle and shoots him in the chest. He's like, fuck you! And just shoots Calhoun. Calhoun falls over.
He becomes a man, finally.
Yeah.
he's like, oh shit, I'm gonna die now. So he shoots him, Calhoun falls over, Boyd's standing there staring at him, and Calhoun sits up laughing. So it's like, all right, what the fuck just happened? You know, why is he not dead?
The double tap.
Right. Well, with an old musket, and it's kind of hard to do. But So Boyd starts panicking. Calhoun stands up and he just starts walking at Boyd and like waving his hands like, come on. So Boyd doesn't know what to do, looks at the cliff, looks back at Calhoun. Now, I don't know which way I would have gone here. I don't think I would have gone the way Boyd decided to do, but he runs and jumps off the cliff.
But of course the trees break his fall.
Yeah,
he knew that was going to happen.
Every single branch on the way down. See, now, every time I see that in a movie, I always think the same thing. How do they not get impaled on anything?
Right.
How do these jagged pieces of wood that they're breaking and falling on top of not impale them? But yeah, that's one of those.
Movie's got a movie.
Yeah, I was just going to say, that's one of those movie got a movie situations.
And he ends up in this little, like, covered hole.
Well,
maybe
yeah,
a grave. And then Reich, like, he freed Reich from the tree. And Reich is still alive because he starts strangling Boyd.
I love that moment, too. That's so...
And then, like, he just continues to fall, and he's like, I'm dead.
Right. Well, because, oh, yeah, that...
Okay. I'm just pissed because he's lost his food now.
Right. Well, that's the thing. Calhoun, who turns out to be, you know, Ives, he's looking down from the cliff top, watching, like, you know, I love it because he kind of whistles. He's like, and then he's going, like he's making the sound effects of Boyd falling. But we see Boyd hit every tree branch on the way down, hits the ground, starts tumbling down the hill, rolls over Reich, who's laying there with a knife in his gut, and pulls Reich with him, and they start tumbling back down the hill and then fall into the hole where Reich gets hung up on the tree branches, and that's when he's strangling Boyd upside down. It's fantastic. But yeah, then he falls in the hole on top of him. Like you said, just goes, blah. he's dead.
I'm dead.
And Calhoun's looking, he's looking down from the clifftop, and he starts sniffing at the air like a fucking animal. And then he wanders down, makes his way down the cliffside and sniffing throughout the forest. And we see Boyd down in the hole, and there's like branches covering on top of him. So it's kind of hard to see where he is. And Ives, or Calhoun, is right outside of right outside the hole, and he's sniffing again. And Boyd kind of plays dead for a moment, and Calhoun walks away. So he couldn't find Boyd, and we cut to that night. We see Boyd tries to get up. Ugh. Yeah, compound fracture.
When the bone is sticking out your skin, it is not a good sign.
Nope. And he bites down on a branch and shoves the bone back in. Oof. It's just, ouch. Now we get this time passing montage where we see Cleves back at Fort Spencer cutting wood. We see Calhoun dragging Toffler inside the cave laughing. We see the full moon. Then we cut back to Boyd covering himself with branches and covering Reich with branches and trying to eat some pine needle or some pine bark. Then we cut to Martha outside the fort watching the horizon. It's daytime again, looking for her brother and the others. Then back to Boyd in the hole at night, shivering. Then cut to day again with Calhoun sitting by the river, gnawing on some bones. Back
and
to Boyd
spitting
in the
out
hole.
The bones right. Into the river.
Back to Boyd in the hole, and we see he takes Reich's coat. And
he goes,
"You're
not cold, are you?"
And then we see Calhoun the next morning happily skipping rocks by the river. And by this point, we see it's now a crescent moon, so we know some time has passed. Boyd looks increasingly sickly, like he's very pale. He looks very very much like he's on death's door.
And now the movie turns into Castaway, and Reich is Wilson. Tell me what to do!
Exactly. Yeah, Boyd starts telling Reich's dead body that, you know, he needs to know what to do. He needs direction, blah, blah, blah. And then he looks down at the corpse. He takes the knife out of Reich's gut. And we see him, what he's picturing. He's picturing, like, raw meat, and then he sees the Wendigo drawing that George showed him, he sees blood, and then he looks at Reich, and he tells him that you're safe now, you're dead, they can't hurt you anymore, and he stabs into his leg and starts slicing a piece off. Yep. And we cut to the next day. We see a renewed Boyd climbing up out of the hole. And Boyd treks back across the snowy wilderness to Fort Spencer. Now, we know some time has passed because they said it was 3 to 4 days. But the way they made it look is it made it look like he climbed out of the hole and just like in an hour was back at Fort Spencer.
Right. Not only that, but so some time has passed. I've never eaten human flesh, but I would think like with hamburger or chicken or any type of meat, you don't want to eat it when it has been sitting out.
True. But you also got to figure this was simpler times when refrigeration really wasn't a thing. So they're probably used to eating half rancid meat.
That's true. And he was probably shitting his brains out inside of that little hole.
It was really cold out though too.
That's true.
And that's it. It's in Nevada, and the mountains there get really cold in the winter.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, I mean, I don't think it would go bad as fast
quickly.
As if,
I don't know. Movie still makes me hungry. I don't know.
I've never had issues eating anything watching a horror film, so I don't know. I tend to eat while watching a horror film, to be honest.
I can eat during certain ones, but there are ones that I definitely cannot eat during, like any kind of trauma or like bad 80s B movie, like something like Basket Case, I couldn't eat during. And it's not so much that there's anything about the film that inherently grosses me out. It's just more so there's just like a certain griminess to the movie that makes me not want to eat. There's a lot of films like that where I'm like, no, I can't do it. Now, Friday the 13th, Nightmare on Elm Street, any of those, like, I'm fine. In fact, I distinctly recall in Nightmare on Elm Street Part 3, when we rented it, like, we used to rent, like I've said this before on the show, we used to rent horror movies every Friday night. Some of them we'd watch as a family. It was usually dependent on whether or not my dad wanted to see it. If he didn't care, then it was usually just me, my brother, and my sister watching it. But the Nightmare on Elm Street movies, for whatever reason, he always watched with us. And I remember very distinctly us watching Part 3, eating spaghetti. And there's that scene where the kid has his veins pulled out and is puppeteered. And I remember my mom getting really nauseous. But yeah, I remember eating spaghetti and watching that scene. So every time I watch that movie, I think of spaghetti. But just a weird side tangent. So we cut to Boyd arriving back at Fort Spencer. Cleve sees him and calls out for Knox and Martha. And then we get a little montage of Boyd in bed being treated by Knox. We see him eating and drinking, having nightmares, almost like going through withdrawal. And then all the while we hear Martha singing, like kind of over top of the scene, very sadly singing, like she's mourning her brother. And then Boyd goes out to see Martha, like he goes out to her little teepee out there, and he talks to her about he's looking for the Wendigo drawing, and he begs her to tell him how to stop it. He's like, Martha, how do you stop it? And she tells him, you don't. You ever give yourself. Wendigo eats. You must eat, or he must eat more, never enough. He only takes, never gives. To stop the Wendigo, you give yourself. You must die. So basically, Boyd's fucked. Like, you're either going to stay a Wendigo or you're going to die, one or the other. So we cut to General Slauson and his men arriving back at Fort Spencer. And Slauson tells Boyd that they found nothing, no evidence of Calhoun or the missing men from Fort Spencer. And basically, they don't believe him. They don't believe Boyd. He says, we need a supportable explanation. Now, your story, this, I love this, he goes, Wendigee. He goes, is the stuff of campfire tales. And his second-in-command, Lindis, goes to say something. He goes, would you stop squirming, Lindis? I know I mispronounced it. I'm making a point. That whole sequence cracks me up.
Mm-hmm.
But he says, my point is, Captain, we need facts, not myths. I told you the facts, sir. And he goes, Boyd, if you altered your story now, it wouldn't be perceived as retracting a lie, only clarifying a muddled recollection. The day we spoke to you, you were out of your head with fever. He says, I was coherent then and I'm coherent now, sir. He goes, I distinctly remember, and then he cuts him off. He goes, perhaps up there in the wilderness, you got separated from your company. That's why I'm giving you this second opportunity. He goes, I advise that you change your story, Boyd. And then Slauson signals Lindis, who leaves the room. Outside, we see Cleves and Martha watching as the new colonel arrives. We don't see his face, and we just see Lindis and Knox greeting him. Lindis brings the new colonel to meet Slauson and Boyd. In walks Lindis and the new colonel, and Slauson says to Boyd, he goes, Captain, this is Colonel Ives. And he goes, Colonel, Captain Boyd. And we see.
Well, smack my ass and call me George. It's Calhoun.
Right. He's a little clean shaven now. That'll come up. But, you know, he's got a little goatee and a mustache now instead of a full on beard. And
which makes him look like a completely different person. Not
right. But it'll play a role in a moment. And Boyd, like, his reaction is honestly perfect. Like, I don't know. I mean, how the hell would you react seeing this monster that put you through hell? Like, he just almost passes out and, like, drops to the floor and cowers. Like, it's just, he looks like he had a panic attack. And he goes, like, you know, he's freaking out, kind of cowering. And Slauson tells Lindis and Ives to go wait outside and scolds Boyd. And Boyd desperately tries to tell Slauson that Ives is Calhoun. That's him. And he's like, you know, this is absolutely ridiculous. And he's like, tell Knox. He goes, Knox saw him. Knox will know who it is. So they go and talk to Knox. And I love this. He goes, he's looking at Ives and he goes, he don't look familiar to me. He goes, I do remember the man wore a beard. And he goes, but as I was saying, I was feeling a bit ill that day. And Boyd goes, you were drunk. And then that's when Slauson reprimands Boyd again. And then Knox goes, well, Boyd, you said you fired on this Calhoun and you hit him in the shoulder. He goes, so that would leave a mark now, wouldn't it? So they call in Ives and they are like, can you humor us for a moment and show us your shoulder? And he has to like strip off all of his layers.
He's like, what kind of place have you sent me to?
Right. He's like, well, my last physical examination was only a few months ago, Captain or Colonel. So, yeah, so he shows him his shoulder. There's no wound. And he goes, now the other shoulder. And there's a moment pause where you think, like, oh, maybe it's going to be there. And then he shows his other shoulder, and there's no wound. So Slauson, or Ives says to Slauson, is there a problem? And he goes, not with you, Colonel. And they walk out. So now we cut to Cleves and Martha talking in, like, a little, like, I don't know, cooking shack. A little cooking shanty. And, Cleves tells Martha that Boyd said that Ives is the reason that everyone's dead, that Ives killed everybody. And he goes on to tell her, he goes, I think it's Boyd. He went loco. He goes, I think he's the reason no one came back. And while he's talking, Boyd kind of pokes his head in the door and is overhearing it. And Cleves turns around looking all nervous. Like, he has that look of like, oh shit, he's right behind me, isn't he?
Uh-huh.
And he turns around. Boyd comes in. He goes, I'm here to warn you. And he goes, okay, Captain. He goes, consider yourselves warned. And he grabs the knife that Cleves was using to chop up meat. And he goes, do you need this? And he's brandishing it at Cleves' face. And he goes, no, sir. And he goes, oh, good. And he walks away holding the knife. Like, he just looks zoned out. It's really creepy. And so
it's like he's stoned for the rest of the movie.
Yeah.
And have between stoned and, like, tripping balls.
Right. Mm. So we cut to dinner. And we see Ives isn't eating the ribs that Cleves made, and Knox comments on it. He goes, you don't like ribs, Colonel? And he goes, he says, I can never forget it used to be an animal. And then he goes, aw, sentimental fella. And then Ives turns to Boyd and says, you don't eat. He goes, what about you, Captain? You don't eat meat? And they have this kind of veiled conversation. And he goes, only as a last resort. And he goes, oh, pity. So they kind of have this like back and forth. You know, Knox looks really confused. Cleves looks really confused. Like, what the hell's going on? Then we cut to Boyd watching Cleves set up graves for the fallen men. And then out of nowhere, Boyd comes up behind Cleves, clobbers him in the back of the head with a mallet, and starts stabbing him, slicing him open, and eating him. Cleves starts laughing at Boyd, and we cut back. Boyd is in his room, still watching Cleves out the window. He's having these visions of killing and eating people.
Sexual food fantasies.
Pretty much. So we cut to later that night, and we see the group all sitting in the living room. Boyd looks like he's going to fall asleep. Knox and Cleves are playing chess while Knox keeps cheating every time Cleves looks away. Ives is reading, and Martha is making an arrow. So now Martha and Cleves keep watching Boyd, and Boyd is trying to watch Ives, and Ives is paying no one any attention. He slams his book shut, which causes Boyd to jump up and brandish his knife at Ives. Martha jumps up and brandishes her knife at Boyd. And meanwhile, Knox cheats it and beats Cleve at chess. And Ives laughs it off, and he's like, well, I'm off to bed. And then we cut outside. We see Boyd is sitting out there with the knife as Ives comes out to have a smoke, and Boyd is just watching him. Cleves comes out, sees Boyd sitting there with the knife, and tells him to go to bed. Ives walks past Boyd, and Boyd follows. Now, they end up having this conversation.
A little heart-to-heart, if you will.
Indeed. Where Ives says to him, he says, I found your Private Reich out there, or what was left of him. You didn't finish. Well, I can't blame you. He was tough, but then a good soldier ought to be. And then Ives takes a really deep breath, like he's smoking his little, like, cigarillo. And he goes, you know, not that long ago, I couldn't do that. Could barely take a breath without coughing up a pint of blood. Tuberculosis. That along with fierce headaches, depression, suicidal ambition, I was in pretty horrible shape. In fact, I was on my way to a sanatorium to convalesce, more likely to die. When en route, an Indian scout told me a curious story. A man eats the flesh of another, he steals his strength. He absorbs the man's spirit. Well, I just had to try. Consequently, I ate the scout first, and you know, he was absolutely right. I grew stronger. Later, through circumstance, my wagon train grew lost in the Rockies. And he goes, and then that's when Boyd goes, I've heard this story before. And he goes, I ate 5 men in 3 months. Tuberculosis vanished, as did the black thoughts. I reached Denver that spring feeling happy and healthy and virile. And then that's when Boyd goes, did you eat her too? And he goes, well, as a matter of fact. And he goes, you're disgusting. And then Boyd, Ives just starts laughing at him.
This is like the interview with the vampire.
Oh, very much.
That reminded me of it.
Oh, absolutely. I could totally see that. And then Ives goes on to tell Boyd what he can't understand about him is that he's tasted it. He's felt his power, and yet he's resisting. And Boyd tells him because it's wrong. And Ives goes, ah, morality, the last bastion of a coward. He gets in pretty close, and Boyd slashes him with the knife, cutting Ives' hand. Ives holds up his now bloody hand and is asking him if he can smell it. And he goes, the scent always jogs the memory. And he begins taunting him, trying to tempt him into, you know, licking the blood. And Boyd jumps on Ives, puts a knife to his throat. Martha runs up out of nowhere, holds her knife to Boyd's throat, tells him, you die. And then Knox comes out drunk and wanting to know what the hell is going on. And Ives tells him that he was on his way to the latrine when Boyd attacked him. Boyd tells him he's lying. Knox tells him he's putting him under arrest. And then Knox tells Martha to go wake up Cleves and put Boyd under arrest. I love that Knox is like, I'm putting you under arrest. Martha, go get Cleves. Put him under arrest.
Well, he's got to finish his bourbon.
Right. So inside, we see Knox bandaging up Ives' hand. And Martha comes in, like, empty-handed. And he goes, did you find... Or she goes, she can't find Cleves. And he goes, did you check around outside? And she goes, no. And I love the way he says, he goes, well, check around outside, woman. Like, he's just got this long drawl. And she just looks annoyed and walks back outside. And she hears something over by the stables and goes to check. She finds all of the horses have been slaughtered and hung up in the barn.
Goodbye, horses.
I didn't even think of that. That's perfect. So she comes back to tell Knox, and she's yelling for him, you know, Major Knox, Major Knox. And he comes running over to see what's going on, and he's looking at her outside the window when all of a sudden blood starts dripping on Martha's face.
Rainy blood!
So Knox comes running outside to see what the fuck is happening. Ives just sits in the living room, seemingly unfazed. And Knox gets out there, and both he and Martha look up, and they see Cleves dead on the roof. So Knox goes inside, walks up, and just headbutts Boyd in the face. And goes, that was for Cleves. And then he goes, this is for my horse. And he punches Boyd in the mouth, knocking him out cold. So the next morning, Knox goes out to Martha, and he says that he and Ives have agreed that Boyd needs to be placed in a military prison as soon as possible, but that requires someone traveling to San Miguel by foot to get General Slauson. He goes, any volunteers? And Martha just raises her hand, looking defeated. And then we see Martha leaving for San Miguel. And we see Boyd chained up in his room. Ives comes in and wipes his hand across Boyd's, like, bloody nose, and then sniffs the blood and lovingly sucks it from his fingers. Like, that was just disgusting. Like, ooh, here's some booger blood.
It was very sexual,
the way it was. Did it. Yeah, definitely.
Which, I need to comment here, in the last episode, I kept trying to say bloody nose and nosebleed, and it kept coming out as nose blood, and I didn't realize it until I listened back to it. So I do want to address this, that I know it's called a nosebleed, but I kept saying nose blood for whatever reason and did not catch it until I recorded.
I caught it. I just didn't want to question you. I thought maybe that's how you said it.
No, I when I was listening back, I went, nose blood? Where the fuck did I get that from? And then I said it again, and I'm like, oh, Jesus Christ.
Well, yeah, so you said it again, so I was like, okay, I guess this is how he says it. I'm not going to correct him.
No, that was just me not realizing, you know, I said nose bleed and bloody nose at the same time.
That's great.
So, yeah, that's one of the things about this show that I will find when editing is I'll go back and be like, motherfucker, did I just really say it like that?
I like how, like, he had noticed you had said it wrong. I was just like, oh, no, that's maybe just how he learned it or something, and just let it go.
Oh, that Mike and his way of saying nose blood.
Me talk good. Oh man, so Ives is sucking the nose blood from his fingers, and so then we cut to Ives chopping onions and cooking. Knox notices Chekhov's sword is missing from above the mantle, and Boyd calls out for Knox, wanting to know if he's still alive. We see Knox, like, walk into view of his bedroom. And he goes, shut up. Then he walks away. And we see Knox comes over to Ives and tells him that his sword is missing. Ives tells him he hasn't seen it. And he goes, what are you cooking? And he goes, oh, it's a stew. And he goes, oh, can I help out? He goes, no, but perhaps later you'll contribute. Foreshadow. And Boyd keeps calling out to Ives. And he goes, when did you do it? He goes, do what, Captain? He goes, kill Cleves and the horses. He goes, I was watching you the whole time. I love this because Knox runs over to Boyd, pissed off. And he goes, you shut up about Cleves and the horses or I'll knock you out again. And while he's yelling at him, we see someone walk through frame brandishing Chekhov's sword. Then Knox closes Boyd's door and notices that the front door to the little cabin is open. He goes, well, how did that get open? Yep. And he goes and closes it, and then he turns and he sees something off camera and goes, good gracious. And then someone walks through frame and swings the sword. Knox falls down.
Beheaded. Nope.
We cut to Boyd, and he hears the fuss, and he's calling out for Knox as someone's approaching the door. Now, we don't see who it is. We just hear the footsteps coming up. The door opens, and surprise, it's a bloody but very alive Colonel Hart, who greets Boyd and says, I hated doing that. And then as Ives is dragging Knox's headless corpse away, he says, I told you my regiment had certain restorative properties. So Boyd realizes that it was Hart who killed Cleves and the horses, and Hart confirms it. He then tells Boyd that his... He asks him about his leg. He goes, it still hurts, doesn't it? He goes, it doesn't have to. And he tells him his story about what was going on. He goes, I remember feeling panic as my life slipped away. It was like drowning in darkness. And then there was nothing. He goes, and then I woke up and Ives was feeding me. By the time I had regained my senses, there was no turning back. I feel terrific. And then Boyd goes, so you're going to kill me now? And he goes, oh, no, it's lonely being a cannibal. Tough making friends. That line cracked me up. But he goes on to tell him that they like him and they're going to bring him into the fold, but he's got to eat. And they go outside. We see Ives butchering Knox. He hands the cleaver over to Hart and tells him to take over.
Because I forgot how he said it, but that essentially that he pickled himself and there's no pink.
Yeah, that's true. I forgot about that. Oh, man. And then, so he hands over the cleaver and Boyd and Ives kind of go on walking. And Ives is explaining to Boyd that there's with the new gold rush going on and the westward expansion, he says, come April, it'll start all over again. Thousands of gold hungry Americans will pass through on their way to new lives. And he goes on to tell him that they won't kill indiscriminately, but rather selectively. They don't want to break up families. And Boyd tells him, you're going to get caught. And Ives says, if it's just Hart and me, then yeah, maybe. But that's why we need others. He goes, you for one, General Slauson. Of course, we've no wish to recruit everyone. We've got enough mouths to feed as it is. Boyd refuses him, and Ives tells him that it's not courage to resist. It's courage to accept him. He said, you're already one of us. Well, almost. You hunger for it. You just won't resign yourself to it. And then Ives tries to convince Boyd to give in. Boyd tells him that he can't. And that's when Ives turns to him and stabs him in the gut, telling him not to worry. It's not fatal as long as you take the necessary precautions. Now we cut to Hart ladling up some stew. He says, stew a la Major Knox. This will fix you right up. And he plops the stew down in front of Boyd, who's like, Boyd's sitting on the couch, covered in blood, gurgling, bloody mouth, bloody gut. Ives is sitting there happily eating his stew. Hart's sitting down eating his stew, and he's like, well, isn't this civilized? I was like, oh, that's fucked up. And then, you know, Ives is just happily eating, and that's when he turns to Boyd and tells him, you know, Ben Franklin once said, eat to live, don't live to eat. And he kind of he smiles at him as he takes another bite, like, you know, this is going to make you live. And then Ives tells Boyd that he can choose to live or die. Boyd gurgles up some blood and starts shoveling stew into his mouth. Now we cut to the next day or a few days later. We see Boyd very healthy, very healed up. Ives and Hart are preparing for General Slauson to arrive. And Hart brings Boyd some more stew and checks his wound. And tells him, you know, that it's healed up nicely. And Boyd tells him he could use some fresh air. Hart says, well, or he goes, can you be trusted? And Boyd says, of course not. And then Hart unshackles Boyd. We see Ives go and watch for the general. And Boyd and Hart are now in Hart's old room. And we see Hart pull out some walnuts from the drawer from, like, the beginning. But now he can crush them with his hand. So he's clearly much stronger. And he starts talking about his books. He starts waxing on about all of his books that he had. And he says, all my books are gone. I'll miss them. Plato, Aristotle. For two millennia struggling with the nature of man, the ideal society, morality. Boil it down, it's the same issue we can't, or the same issue we can't solve today. Happiness and how to achieve it. And Hart takes out a dagger from his drawer. And then Boyd tells him, Aristotle sought truth, Colonel, not happiness. And he goes, truth. I led my whole life according to what I thought was right and true. And look where it got me, Fort Spencer. Boyd tries to convince Hart to free him, like to let him go, and he'll, basically, he's going to kill Ives. And Hart says that he can't. And Boyd talks about the nightmares and about who they've killed. And then Hart starts spazzing out and tells him that you have to kill to live. So we cut to Ives watching the horizon. And we see Slauson and company making their way, like, up to Fort Spencer. And he goes, breakfast, lunch, and reinforcements. We cut back to Boyd telling Hart again that he's going to kill Ives. And Hart finally agrees and puts the knife in the desk. And he basically tells him that he goes, I can't do this anymore. He goes, you have to do me a favor. Kill me. And Boyd looks at him and he's begging him. He's like, please make it quick. I can't do this anymore. So Boyd walks up, grabs the knife, walks back to Hart and slices his throat right as Ives is walking up to the window and sees the blood squirting on the window. So Hart gurgles, falls down dead. Ives comes in pissed off. Boyd grabs the sword.
You got some explaining to do, mister.
Lo sé.
Yep.
You got some explaining to do, man.
He grabs the sword from the mantle. They start fighting. Ives runs off. Boyd gives chase, searches the ground. I love this because Ives just like jumps down like through the floor of the loft, like above Boyd. It's not like he jumps off the loft. He jumps through the loft and then tackles Boyd, starts beating him with a log.
That's how we did it back in the simpler times.
I'm going to drop through the wood and beat you with a log.
I heard on the commentary, the director said that, and now this makes loads of sense, like the prop department, they designed the fight around like basically the only three like props they could use, I guess, which was like the knife, the pitchfork, like the log and something else.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like just kind of like trying to like revolve around how to use those things over and over again.
Oh yeah. And this fight is, it's great because it's not your stereotypical like action scene. It's, I mean, these guys are fucking each other up, but they both already look kind of like defeated throughout the fight.
They're so tired, but neither of them will cry uncle.
Right.
Yeah. It's like the they live fight kind of.
It very much is. Yeah. Like Boyd loses the sword because he's getting hit with the log, and then he grabs a pitchfork and stabs Ives with it. They struggle. Ives takes out a dagger and stabs Boyd repeatedly. Boyd gets a cleaver and hacks Ives in the arm with it. Then he starts to beat Ives with a log. And they try to choke each other.
Which is just fucking great.
Oh, I love it that they kept, there's all these bladed implements and they both keep grabbing a log to beat the other one with.
Right?
But they try to choke each other out. Ives stabs Boyd again. Boyd gets up and runs and kind of collapses part of the shed onto Ives. Then Boyd makes his way into like the stables where all the traps are. Ives digs his way out and gives chase. They run up. Ives grabs Boyd, takes the knife out of his back, and it looks like he's going to stab him with it. But then he just kind of drops the knife and they start choking each other again. And they struggle and fall onto a massive like bear trap.
It was a dinosaur trap.
It really was like that thing. I've never seen a bear big enough to need that. But they fall onto it. So Ives is like his back to the teeth, and Boyd is on top of him, and he slams Ives' head onto the trigger, and the trap comes down and latches onto Boyd, now squishing the two of them together. So now they're both bleeding out from massive wounds, and Ives looks at him and goes, "That was really sneaky." And he goes, "You know, if you die first, I'm definitely going to eat you. The question is, if I die, what are you going to do?" And he looks at him and goes, "Bon appetit." And we see Martha, the general, and Lindis arriving and looking around. The general goes right over to the stew and starts sniffing it. And we see Ives and Boyd dying. And Ives looks at him and says, "Eat or die." Then we cut to Slauson. He tastes the stew and he likes it. Dun, dun, dun. And then Ives lets out a long, slow death rattle. Boyd watches him die. Martha comes in, finds Boyd, and finds Boyd laying down to die. The music kind of kicks up. She just nopes right the fuck out of there and leaves Fort Spencer altogether.
She's like, "Fuck these white people. They are fucking crazy."
Mm-hmm. I love it because she opens the door, she sees it, she closes the door like, "Nope, nope, no." All I can picture is that Danny DeVito meme where he's shaking his head going, "No."
Yes, yep, exactly.
And she just walks away, and you see her like walking out of the fort altogether, like no belongings, no horse. She's just like, "Fuck all y'all." But
she's like Mary Tyler Moore. She's going to make it on her own.
Exactly. So then we pan out to just dead Ives laying, or dead Ives and dead Boyd, laying on each other in a pool of blood. The credits start to roll. The end. So I fucking love that movie so much. Like, it's just so fun. But that ending, like, I love that fight scene. I love the way it ends. I love the question of, you know, is Slauson now going to become a cannibal? Like, how's this going to play out?
Mm-hmm.
So I love it. But so yeah, that was Ravenous from 1999. I do want to say something. I've noticed, I was looking through the trivia, and I noticed some very definite bullshit. Like, you know how I'm always saying IMDb tends to have those questionable, like, is that real? Is it not real? Mm-hmm. Here's one of those things that sounds like it could be real, but is easily disputed. One of the first things in the trivia says it's 25 minutes into the film before Captain Boyd, who is virtually in every scene, utters his first full sentence. And what? I wrote...
What?
Yeah, exactly. That's what it said in the trivia. And I wrote, bullshit alert, Boyd speaks at 12 minutes and 34 seconds where he says the word cowardice.
Is that a complete sentence?
They said... Well, yeah, I guess. Okay, full sentence.
But still, like, who cares?
Right.
Who would be like, wow, check this out, this unique thing. It's not a full and complete...
Yeah, he fucking talks.
Yeah. Me talk good.
Me talk good. Oh, man. But yeah, I mean, there wasn't a lot of trivia, so I didn't really write much down. But the commentary, now I know, Eric, I know you said you listened to it, but this is one of those commentaries that I really do like. I've listened to it a few times. And I know I already mentioned the meat stew moment where, you know, they had to do multiple takes. And we saw, you know, poor Guy Pierce, you know, shoveling lamb into his mouth and chomping on it when, you know, the idea of eating meat made him nauseous. But he was a trooper and made it through. But, yeah, I mean, if you guys like this film, this is definitely one of those ones that the commentary is worth your while.
Yeah, I actually didn't listen to it all the way through. I ran out of time. But,
it's a good one.
Yeah. I'm sad the director has passed. Like, also sad, like, I mean, not a lot of people... I think this movie has kind of gained notoriety. I keep waiting for some like reissue of the soundtrack to come out on vinyl because I still have my CD from 1999 of it. Mm-hmm. But like, I've read that it's like gained momentum. Like a lot of people like this movie, but at the same time, it's still kind of like hidden. And I almost want it to like stay that way so it doesn't get like remade as some stupid shit on Netflix or something. I don't know. Like I want it to remain as is, but at the same time, like, I'm like, I really wish it had found a bigger audience so that she could have made like a lot more, because it's my understanding she had like no prep time for the movie because the other director left.
Yep.
And like I think this is true, that Robert Carlyle had a lot to getting her on the movie,
right,
because he was already in it. But
and he had worked before on Priest.
Okay. And yeah, like I wish she would have done more horror movies, because I could have seen a lot of, I could watch those all day. Like,
so. Oh, absolutely, she was a great director.
Yeah. Oh yeah.
Like, and I feel like you mentioned this being remade, and the first thing I thought of was like, oh god, if they remade this on Netflix, be like, we're gonna do Ravenous, but we're gonna set it in the 80s. Like, I could totally.
They would have, like, I don't know. Like, everything has to be explained. There would be some whacked out, like, fucked up, like, thing about the magic of it and how you exactly become a cannibal. And in this movie, it's not the point. It doesn't matter. Like, I feel like once you make that the point of your horror movie, mm-hmm. you're already, like, lost. Like, if your whole point is just, like, oh, and this happened, and this is behind this. It's like, so wait, you didn't really start with a theme or a story point.
Right.
You just started with an explanation, like a recipe. It's like, well, it's got to taste good. That's the exactly. only important part.
Well, and I think especially when it comes to horror films, because we see this so frequently in horror, is where they have this need to explain their mythology. And a lot of times not knowing is the best thing. And again, I know we'll eventually get to it, but Texas Chainsaw Massacre, like, I always bring this up. If you watch the original Texas Chainsaw, it becomes apparent that Leatherface has distinct personalities. And depending on the personality he's portraying, it depends on which mask he's wearing. Like, but they never point it out. They never explain it. It's just part of the character. In the remake, they felt not only did they have to explain that, but they were like, oh, well, he wears the mask because he's deformed. And it's like, No, the moment you start explaining the mythology too closely, you ruin stuff. Like, leave some mystery to it. Let the audience figure it out. You know, that make, to me at least, that makes it much more enjoyable. Now, if you have very distinct rules, like, you know, where it has to follow, I don't know, like, to kill this monster, you must do this. Like, if you set that up from the beginning, you better follow through with it, because that's another thing I really can't stand is when you set up rules and then they just kind of fudge the rules by the end of it. It's like, wait, no. Either don't set it up or follow through.
Yeah, I feel like a rule is okay, but like when you're just explaining, like, I think people can see a door and take that, like, and open it and take, like, just at face value, you know, like, I don't know why I said door. Like, but you know what I mean? Like, you can just see Jason Voorhees with a hockey mask, and it doesn't need to be he played hockey or, like, loved, you know, the Sabres as a kid. Like, it's just...
Oh my god, I want to see, like, a backstory of Jason being, like, a really big hockey fan.
You know they're gonna do it. Like, they're gonna do it. The second the legal battle's done, they're gonna do it, and it's...
Oh. That would be amazing. It's so bad.
I don't know why I went on a fearful tangent of, like, them remaking Ravenous, but I hope to God they never... Or if they do, it's something that's completely different than this.
Yeah, no, this happens a lot in horror, as there are films that just kind of, like, they hit a point where you don't need a remake, you don't need a sequel, you don't need more. Like, it's the perfect bite, you know, just get that
no
film.
Pun intended.
Indeed. But yeah, this, like, I could not see this film, and I love remakes, but I could not see this film being remade in a way where I would enjoy it as much or more than the original. Now, there are plenty of remakes, and I've said this many times on the show, there are plenty of remakes that I like either as much or in some rare cases more than the original. But there are also a plethora of remakes that I'm like, that's a good film, but it doesn't even come close to the original. Like, I always look at, like, Poltergeist, for example. Like, I didn't hate the remake of Poltergeist. I felt like they fucked up a lot of stuff that they, because they didn't allow themselves to kind of break free from the mold of the first film. Every time they tried to, they reined it back in. And I felt like what they were trying to do was more interesting than remaking the original. But, you know, it is what it is. So it's not an unlikable film, but it's nowhere near as good as the original. I feel the same way about Nightmare on Elm Street. I know that one got a ton of hate, but it's like, I feel like it's a good film, but it's just nowhere near as good as the original.
I've seen both of those, and I remember not disliking Poltergeist, but, like, I can't remember a single thing from the Poltergeist remake. I don't even remember who was in it. I know I watched it at the drive-in.
Oh my god, why can't I think of his fucking name? He's in so many movies. I'm picturing him from Galaxy Quest. He was, like, the red shirt guy in Galaxy Quest. He was in
Sam Rockwell. Yeah.
Sam Rockwell. He plays the dad. I mean, it was a really good film, but my beef with that, and I know I'm kind of on a tangent here, but my beef with it was, like, they would start to do their own thing, and it was really interesting. And then it was like, so it was almost like you could hear one of the producers being like, "Hey, do the clown scene now." And then they remade clown scene. And they start doing their own thing. "Hey, do the thing with the tree." "Okay, we'll do the tree scene." And they start, you know, doing their own thing again. "Hey, remember how the bodies floated up from the pool? Well, we don't have a pool, so make them just come up from the ground." You know, it was just like, it was all these sequences that felt out of place because they were doing their own thing and it didn't need to be remade. You know, and I felt that way with Nightmare as well, because, like, the greatest scenes from the original Nightmare on Elm Street in the remake just pale in comparison, because they shoehorn them in and try to, like, make them stand out, and by doing so they make them seem dumb. Like the Freddy leaning out of the wall behind Nancy sequence in the original is fucking fantastic, and in the remake it's a CGI, like, cartoon. It looks terrible. And then the body bag sequence, which is arguably one of the most frightening scenes in a slasher movie, where we see you know, Tina in the body bag being dragged away by an invisible force. We just see her standing in a hallway in the middle of nowhere for no reason whatsoever. It was like they just kind of threw it in there last minute. So, yeah, that's my beef with those kind of remakes. But we're not talking about remakes. We're talking about Ravenous. So,
yeah.
Does anybody have any final thoughts on Ravenous?
No, don't eat the stew.
I mean, if you do, just eat the veggies.
But wouldn't the broth already taint it?
I would say you should make a stew, like, and then eat it while you're watching this movie. That just sounds delicious to me. I would do that now.
I did actually have lamb stew this week before watching this movie. Not the same day, but just earlier in the week. But, yeah, so before we wrap this up, we should mention our social medias. As always, if you guys aren't following us, we are The Boogeyman's Closet on both Facebook and Instagram. Maurice is in charge of our Twitter. And what is that, sir?
At Boogeyman's The.
And we are still doing our giveaway contest. The November one is up. We will be announcing or picking the winner, and I think about a week from when this podcast comes out. So definitely check it out. There's a lot of goodies in there, and we still have two really fun prize packages planned for December. So if you're not following us, now's a good time to get in, win some free goodies. And we've been doing every episode, we've been trying to do a spotlight artist. And Susie, I believe you have a spotlight artist for us this week. So what do you got?
So this week, our spotlight artist is the band Yellow Sauce, hailing from Buffalo, New York. One of my buddies from work is in the band. He is Leland Allen. So they are considered a blondcore band, and they take influences from Tenacious D to System of a Down to everything in between. You should definitely check them out. Their Facebook is just Yellow Sauce. Their website is yellowsauce.bandcamp.com, where you can buy their first album. And it's really, really good. It's funny. Like, there's a lot of comedy in their music. I love it. Their Twitter is at Yellow Sauced, so Sauced ED. And their IG, I wrote it down IG, Instagram is yellow_sauce_official.
And I'm not sure if they're still doing it, but since they do sell their stuff through Bandcamp, I know for a while there, the first Friday of every month, all the money you make on Bandcamp actually goes to them, because usually you got to get a percentage to Bandcamp.
But double check with it.
I believe it's still going on. If not, I apologize. But as of this month, I know the first Friday of every month, all the money goes to the bands.
That's awesome.
Yeah, that's a good call, Reese. I'm glad you told me, because I wasn't aware of that either. So I'll make sure anytime I buy stuff on Bandcamp, I'll wait till Friday to do that, because that's good. That's really good.
Just double check. But I know for a few months there, I know the first Friday of every month they were doing that.
Yeah, no,
they're also on Spotify. So check them out on Spotify and then go to Bandcamp, buy their CD. They have some other really cool swag. Space Wizard is one of my favorite songs by them. They're great. Just give them a listen. Go support local music. And I'm going to get off my soapbox now.
And we will be posting on our social media links to their stuff. So if you're not following us, like I said, give us a follow and then you can follow the links. So, yeah. But all right, guys, I think we're going to get ready to wrap this up. Eric, once again, it's always a pleasure having you join us. And I look forward to our next outing.
Absolutely. It's always fun. I always end up derailing it and talking about anything but the movie. But it's fun. I'm glad you guys it's fun to talk to you guys about all this stuff.
We love having you.
Never feel bad. Yeah. We derail ourselves constantly.
Always. Right. I have something to add.
Oh, go for it.
Susie.
Yes.
Who won the football game on Sunday? Did she mute?
No.
Did she try?
You're rubbing my nose in the dirt like I'm a bad puppy.
If you guys don't know, I am an Arizona Cardinals fan.
I will say this: that catch, it was beautiful. We're still I still believe, but that congratulations to your team. That was a beautiful catch.
The Bills are still good. I don't want to call it lucky.
It was lucky.
But it was pretty lucky.
That catch was 2020 in a football game right there.
I mean, come on, look. What about the throw? The throw from Kyler Murray.
Yeah. All right.
I had to rub it in. I apologize.
It's okay. It's okay. That is a well-deserved rub, rubbing my nose in it. So
at least it was a great play to rub it in.
Yes, that's true.
That's all I have to say.
Nice. But all right, guys, well, let's wrap this up and we will be back closing out our Cannibal Month next episode with The Hills Have Eyes. So if you guys want to check that out.
I thought it was called The Eyes Have Hills.
Oh, well, shit, you watched the wrong one.
That's the version that you get on Wish.
Oh, I was just saying, or is that the trauma version?
Yeah, exactly. That's the Bollywood version.
Okay.
But all right, guys, as per usual, this is Mike saying goodbye.
See ya.
Bye.
Peace out.
Thanks for listening. If you enjoyed what you heard, follow us on Instagram at The Boogeyman's Closet, where you can stay up to date with everything we have planned.